Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and in a little while, we'll be hearing from a band called Callers. They'll be playing in the studio, and one of their songs, Turning, has some pretty unusual sounds in it. But it's also kind of melancholy. Hey,
when I have to leave, I see you behind me. When I go to
glitchy and moody and sad. So what's the matter with us all? Why are we drawn to sad songs? Some of us to writing and playing them, and apparently all of us to listening to them. Well, we'll see what the band has to say about it, but first, let's take a look at some sad songs. Some great sad songs. In fact, the 100 best sad songs, at least that's according to author Adam Hotelling, whose new book is called This Will End in Tears, The Miserablest Guide to Music. He joins me here in the studio to talk about it. Adam, I'm at least glad to have you here. I don't know how you're feeling about it.
Absolutely glad to be here. Thank you.
Why write such a miserable book and spend so much time doing it?
I kind of position it as almost a genre unto itself in a way in the book. And I just realized, I also at the top of the book talk about how I figured out, you know, how I came to the conclusion to write it. And I just noticed on my iPod one day randomly that almost every artist that I had in there had this unique connection to sadness or melancholy. And it didn't matter what genre they performed in. It didn't matter when they were performing. And that's what really, it was the fact that it was, you know, it was so many disparate artists that mm-hmm. That was connected to this. That's what really made me think this could be a book.
So from medieval classical music to, you know, contemporary indie rock, mm-hmm. across the spectrum, there is some kind of connection, an emotional connection, if not a sonic one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the important thing for the book was I wanted to choose artists to profile that had a very distinct connection to sadness.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, I mean, most artists, if they have a career of any length, and even if they release one album, they do sad songs. They do, you know, a ballad or two, but I wanted artists that really connected to it.
And were you interested in exploring why we're all drawn to sad songs? Why every artist, as you say, is going to have a sad song somewhere in their repertoire?
Absolutely. That was kind of the thing that really sold it, is everybody glommed on to the idea of, why do sad songs make us happy? That was kind of the thing that everybody just immediately was drawn to.
Mm-hmm. Adam Hotelling, you wrote the book, Why Do Sad Songs Make Us Happy?
I think there's a very intimate connection to sad songs. You know, when you're listening to sad music, you're not playing volleyball on the beach. You're not, you know, at a dinner party necessarily. It's usually you're by yourself, and you're usually in a specific frame of mind if you're listening to more than one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it creates a really intimate connection. And that, there's also an idea of consolation there, that somebody understands what you're going through. And in a way that you may not be able to talk to friends or family about what you're really feeling, but here's this person or this artist that really does understand.
Right. The idea of sympathy in the literal sense of feeling
yeah.
with you. Simpatico maybe would be a better
term.
Yeah,
and there's also a lot of, the release of dopamine that happens when you have really emotionally intense experiences.
Yeah.
And that's really sad music can be like that, and that kind of lights up the reward center and releases a lot of that. So
the book is called This Will End in Tears, The Miserabilist Guide to Music's Top 100 Saddest Songs. Now, you do, in fact, close the book with, you know, the 100 saddest songs. And at number one, with a bullet, is the famed Barber Adagio for Strings.
Yeah.
Which has no words. It's sad, but mm-hmm. you don't know how or why particularly. And yet,
It's got this intense cultural connection with sadness. It's played when, you know, very important people pass away. It's played, you know, every radio station just runs to pull it out. So, and it's also, you know, music directors for film and
Platoon,
absolutely. I think Platoon was possibly the most important use of it, but it's
and
so,
then later sent up in an episode of Seinfeld.
In more than Seinfeld, in fact, that's kind of, it's become such a cultural cue for sadness that it has been used in parody more than once or twice.
Barber's Adagio for Strings tops Adam's list of the 100 saddest songs. The Adagio for Strings by the American composer Samuel Barber. That was originally just a movement of a string quartet, but
yeah.
It has become like a national elegy here in the
Absolutely,
States.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it is at number one on Adam Hotelling's list of the 100 saddest songs, which appears in his book, This Will End in Tears. The subtitle is The Miserabilist Guide to Music, and then further on the cover, it says, Heartbreaks, Teardrops, and the 100 Saddest Songs featuring Johnny Cash, Leonard Cohen, The Cure, John Dowland, Billie Holiday, Joy Division, Radiohead, Frank Sinatra, The Smiths, Townes Van Zandt, and many more. So there are some greats in this world of sad songs.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
You know, so Leonard Cohen, for example.
Leonard Cohen, absolutely, yeah.
Unlike Barber, Cohen is, you know, he plunks out his chords. The the emotion for him is all in the words, right?
No,
I
don't.
Poetry?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's part of it. But in general, his songs are pretty melancholic, I think. I mean, his voice and just deeper voices in general. There are a lot of artists in the book who have very deep, resonant voices. There's Ian Curtis. There's Stuart Staples from the Tindersticks. There's Matt Berninger from the National. That seems to be the kind of voice that works really well. And it's also tied to cello. I have a great quote from Janos Starker in the book that says,
A great classical cellist, yeah.
Yeah, it cannot laugh, but it takes to melancholy perfectly.
Well, now, the thing with Leonard Cohen, though, if you listen to his early records, he almost sounds like, you know, a young Bob Dylan. I mean, he's got a much higher voice than the kind of cavernous sound that we associate with him these days.
Yeah.
Does that mean that his earlier songs are somehow not as sad because the voice hasn't deepened yet?
You know, I don't really believe so, but I think there is some kind of connection that the deeper voice does bring. And so,
well, let's hear a little bit from Leonard Cohen and Famous Blue Raincoat.
You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? Or the last time we saw you, you look so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train. Then you came home without Lily Marlene, and you treated my woman to a flake.
Leonard Cohen's famous blue raincoat. That is some despondent music, Adam Hotelling.
It is.
From
yes.
a guy who you would say is sort of a master of this sort of song.
Absolutely.
Writing.
It's not, but Famous Blue Raincoat is not the song that I put in my top 100.
No, no. What did you put in your top 100?
Dress Rehearsal Rag, mm-hmm. which is such a downer that he doesn't even, I don't think, I'm not sure if he's performed it since he recorded it.
I mean, you could easily have picked Gloomy Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, there's any number of mm-hmm. Leonard Cohen songs that could have gone on your list of the 100 saddest songs. We're speaking with Adam Hotelling about his book, This Will End in Tears, a guide to sad songs across different genres and centuries. And Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Who's a real master of sad songs? And what are some examples of sad songs that work for you? You can leave a comment on our website or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Joseph leaves this on our Facebook page. He suggests Elliot Smith. Now, Elliot is, you know, a tragic figure, you know.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of tragic figures in the book, too. Mm-hmm. So,
Wrestling with his own demons, that certainly comes through in the songwriting. Again, though, people drawn to the voice. Maybe not a cello-like voice, but a very fragile kind of
Absolutely.
Voice.
Absolutely, yeah. And there actually are some very fragile voices in the book as well. But yeah, I think you talk about lyrics with Leonard Cohen, same with Elliot Smith, intensely personal.
And he's on your list with this song, which is at number 77 on Adam's list of the 100 saddest songs.
Haven't loved this hard in a long time. I better stop now before I start crying. Go off to sleep in the sunshine. I don't wanna see the day when it's dying. She's a sight to see,
sight to see.
She's a good to me,
good to me.
I'm all somebody's baby. She's a pretty thing,
pretty thing.
And she knows everything,
everything.
But I'm already somebody's baby. You don't deserve to be lonely, but those drugs you got won't make you feel better.
The late Elliot Smith. This song actually was released posthumously, called Twilight, and it is on Adam Hotelling's list of the 100 saddest songs, which appears in his book, This Will End in Tears, The Miserablest Guide to Music. There are different chapters, you know, a chapter on blue, mm-hmm. I feel blue, I got the blues. A chapter on tears, though, that's really, really interesting. Sketch mm-hmm. that out for us.
Well, I kind of go into some of the physiological aspects of tears. And through different parts of history, tears have been divided up into different categories. And there was this idea of, and I'm not a Latin scholar by any means, but lacrimae decora, mm-hmm. Decorative tears. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was William James who came up with a category of erotic tears. And the Christian church kind of had tears of contrition and tears of grace and tears of gladness and tears of sorrow. And now we kind of divide them into three categories, which are basal tears, which are just the tears that keep your eyes wet,
mm-hmm.
Reflex tears, which when you get an eyelash in your eye, and emotional or psychic tears, which are the tears that fill songs and
right.
movies and all of that. So
at one point in time, and I can actually go back to our Facebook page, Kevin on Facebook suggests the songs of John Dowland. In the mm-hmm. first Elizabethan era, this guy was the king of tears, right?
Yes, this guy, John Dowland, is actually the heart and soul of the book. Sting did that album of John Dowland songs not too many years ago, and, you know, he kind of called him the first pop star in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that for someone being, you know, labeled as the first pop star, that he was such a miserabilist, which ties into the Elizabethan era, but he was just obsessed with tears. So many song after song that included tears in the title.
Including his big hit, Flow My Tears.
Flow my tears, fall from your springs, exiled forever, let
Justin Burwood's recording of perhaps John Dowland's most famous song, Flow My Tears. Although, Adam, you pick another Dowland song for your list.
Yeah, I pick In Darkness Let Me Dwell.
He was such a cheery guy, John Dowland.
He really was. You know, one of the other interesting things I love about him is some of his songs, and I kind of point this out in the book, some of his songs sound strikingly modern. And it's almost as if you speed them up and you put an electric guitar
in there
and it's a Smith song.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting to me.
And, you know, it's worth remembering that back in Elizabethan England, melancholy and crying and stuff, these were sort of metaphors the way, you know, a rapper in the 90s mm-hmm. would sort of present himself as tough and streetwise and stuff.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was part and parcel of being a musician
yeah.
at that point.
And there have been other little eras that, you know, Byronism that kind of came out of Lord Byron
mm-hmm.
and Wertherism that came out of the novella The Sorrows of Young Werther, which was huge at the time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, yeah, those little eras have, you know, like gloom rock during the 80s, which
mm-hmm.
was all the rage.
Adam Hotelling's book is This Will End in Tears, The Miserabilist Guide to Music. Was this a fun book to write?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. As long as I stayed in a good mood,
uh-huh.
this was a thrilling book to write. If anything bad happened in my life, it was a very difficult book to write.
All right. Well, earlier today, we asked our musical guest for the show today, the band Callers, to name a song that made them cry. And here was the response from two members of the band, Ryan Seaton and Sarah Lucas.
I love you more than you'll ever know. Donny Hathaway.
Oh, good job.
It's like the sweetest punch in the face you'll ever receive.
Yeah. Oh, God, that song's amazing. So sad.
If I ever leave you, baby, you can say I told you so. And if I ever hurt you, you know I hurt myself as well. Is that any way for a man to carry on? Do you think I want my loved one gone? Said I love you. More than you'll ever know. More than you'll ever know.
Well, Well, Adam, when Donny Hathaway drops down to the lower part of his register at the end of that phrase there, sort of goes back to what you were saying before, the importance of the voice.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of ideas of, like, rising and falling that really get to emotional release. So
Ryan and Sarah from the band Callers, that is their favorite song that makes them cry. We'll be hearing them singing and playing with the rest of the band later on in the show. On Soundcheck right now, Adam Hotelling talking with us about his book This Will End in Tears, a guide to some of the saddest music ever made. And, all right, so, you know, there are the greats. We've mentioned Leonard Cohen. You mentioned Ian Curtis of the band Joy mm-hmm. Division, Billie Holiday. One artist I wanted to mention or wanted to ask you about before we wrap up, Johnny Ray. Sort of an important figure in the development of the modern sad song.
He's really interesting to me because I do think that he's a little lost to history right now. But he was a really important link between Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley.
How so?
I mean, he was one of the first people to really, one of the first white performers to really imbue his music and performances with Black music at the time. So lots of soul and lots of people were surprised when they, you know, they'd hear a record and then they'd meet him and they'd be surprised that he was white. Mm-hmm. And he'd be booked for, you know, all Black clubs and stuff at the time. And he was one of the first
carrying that torch song thing from Sinatra.
Absolutely. Well, he had his first big hit was Cry, and he, you know, and that was a really big hit. And there's a little story in the book how he went to Europe and, did some touring or whatever, and by the time he came back, Elvis Presley was all the rage, and people had completely forgotten about him. So,
what a sad story.
Yeah.
Adam Hotelling, a real pleasure having you with us, being miserable together here in the studio on Soundcheck today.
Thank you. It was fantastic.
The book is called This Will End in Tears, The Miserablest Guide to Music, and this is Johnny Ray's 1951 hit, Cry.
If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, it's no secret you feel better if you cry.
You can find a Spotify playlist of Adam Hotelling's top 100 sad songs on our webpage at soundcheckworkshop.org. Coming up next, we'll ask a musicologist why we cry when we hear sad music.
Well, these aren't tears of sadness because you're leaving me. I've just been cutting onions. I'm making a lasagna for one.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Despite what the Flight of the Conchords say, it's all right to cry, especially when you listen to music. A moment ago, we heard from a writer who's explored the genre of sad songs. Now let's hear why sad music makes us cry. A while back, I talked with David Huron, the head of Ohio State University's Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Lab, and I pointed out that even though sad music can be so sad, many music lovers actually like listening to him, and I asked him to explain.
Well, aren't they crazy? It certainly is a paradox that so many people would like sad music, and because normally sadness is a negative, what we call a negatively valenced emotion, mm-hmm. and people try everything in their power usually to avoid negative emotions. So it has indeed been the case that we've been following up this as a topic of research and trying to figure out precisely the answer to your question. And there's lots to say there, but it looks like some unique physiology and personality plays a role.
This wouldn't be like something we evolved to do. I would expect from your first answer that it's quite the opposite. I mean, wouldn't we sort of be evolutionarily wired to not go for those negatively valenced emotions?
Well, there are different theories about this, but one of them has to do with contrast. There's the old joke or saw about why do you keep beating your head against the wall? And neuroscience actually lends some credibility to the answer because it feels so good when I stop. So the contrast here, especially when you experience sort of pseudo-sadness, the sadness or sad state where there's actually no reason to feel sad, you can feel pretty good through that whole experience. So the contrast makes a big effect here.
Now, earlier on our show, we talked about music that gives us chills, and you can find that, listeners, on our archives at wnyc.org/soundcheck. The idea that we have a kind of physical response to certain types of music. Is there something similar going on here when people are listening to and really having an emotional reaction to sad music?
Absolutely. The physiological aspects, in the case of chills, where you get goosebumps and the hair stands up on the back of your neck, that's very much a physiological response, which has a beautiful, there's a wonderful explanation for that. But on the other hand, you can also experience what we call breath holding, where people colloquially, they say, oh, the music takes my breath away.
Right.
And literally what they're doing is they're holding their breath. And in the case of crying, of course, you have the tears, you have the constriction in your throat, and so on. That's very much a physiological response. In fact, if you went to your family physician and you described your symptoms, you said, doctor, what's wrong with me? I have watery eyes, I have this nasal congestion, this constriction in my throat. Your doctor would say, well, you're suffering from a systemic allergic response. So actually crying looks for all the world like an allergy. So in each of these cases, in the frisson where you have the chills sort of running up and down your spine with hair standing up on the back of your neck, in the case of awe when you actually stop breathing momentarily, and in the case of crying where you look like you have an allergy, there's a very deep evolutionary and physiological reason why these specific kinds of responses occur.
Wow. We're speaking with David Huron. He's author of Sweet Anticipation, Music and the Psychology of Expectation. Let's sort of define our terms here, David. Sadness does not necessarily equal grief, right? There are two different...
Yeah, that's very true, and it's an important distinction. We commonly tend to think of them as the same thing, but actually... sadness is involved with low physiological arousal. So when you're sad, you slump, you have slumped posture, you tend to be quiet, maybe lose your appetite. Grief, on the other hand, this is a high arousal emotion. Your heart is pounding, you tend to wail or cry, all of those sorts of things. So when we're in a state of mourning, if, you know, your favorite pet dies or something like that, typically what happens is a person will alternate between these two states, a state of active, high arousal grief where they're crying, and a state where there's low arousal sadness, where they're kind of ruminating and they're quite quiet.
Now, there's a song by Chris Isaak, his hit song, Wicked Game. Would you say this is something that kind of shows us that distinction?
That's a very good example, in fact. So sounds related to sadness will have a quieter voice, slower, lower in pitch, more of a kind of monotone where you don't move the pitch very much. There's quite a bit of mumbled speech that happens in a darker timbre.
And that's what we're hearing right now is this. And then when he sort of moves into his upper register and gets a bit more active as a singer, that's more of the grief part. Chris Isaak's Wicked Game. So, David Huron, as you were sort of talking about the song, we were hearing that sort of the verse, which is very softly sung and almost monochromatic, and as we're hearing again in the background, and then the chorus, it's like breaks into this kind of emoting. So that's the distinction between sadness and grief.
Yeah, you
in a 60-second clip.
In most clearly in the case of what we call breaking voice. So when he goes, no,
yeah, yeah.
goes up high into the falsetto.
Oh, come on, David, sell it to me.
Okay, okay. So if I were to really try to give you a crying voice, I'd start speaking sort of this sort of sound.
Mm-hmm.
And what's literally going on here is that you're breaking between, you're alternating between what we call modal voice, which is the normal speaking voice, and falsetto voice. And actually, this is the reason why the allergy plays an important role. When you have an allergy, you end up with that what we call a lump in your throat.
Right.
And what that actually is a constricted pharynx. And when the pharynx constricts like that, it makes the vocal cords very unstable. And as a consequence, you alternate back and forth between these two different. And what he's doing in that piece is he's making those little cry breaks, those little switches between modal and falsetto voice, and it just hits you right in the stomach. You, as a listener, you know exactly what that means. That's grief.
No. Nobody loves no one.
David Huron says it's that jump, like the one Chris Isaak just did over and over in this song, that makes us feel sad. But boy, when you end your song with a line like, nobody loves no one, that might bring you down too. We spoke with David back in January, and you can listen to the full discussion on our website. Up next, the band Callers. They have a sad song or two in their arsenal, and we'll hear one of them as part of their live set next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Callers came to Brooklyn a few years ago by way of New Orleans, and you can hear it in their sound as woozy jazz and southern soul collide with a more frenetic, unpredictable New York pace. The band's third album is called Reviver. It's coming out in October, but today we're getting a preview live in the Soundcheck studio. Here is the band Callers with a live performance of Heroes.
I'm not writing in time to subscribe to all these heroes.
the band is called Callers, and that's a live performance in the Soundcheck studio of their song Heroes, which will be on their next album called Reviver, which is due on October 9th, and the members of Callers here in the studio, Sarah Lucas singing and playing guitar, Ryan Seaton playing guitar, doing some backing vocals, Seth Manchester on guitar, and Keith Souza playing behind our drum kit. Sarah and Ryan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So that song, Heroes, that's inspired by the poetry of Gwendolyn Brooks, is that right?
Well, the record as a whole, it kind of began with going back and reading some of her poetry and kind of being inspired by the rhythm and the language and the beauty of her poetry in particular.
Mm-hmm. Now, for folks who haven't read her, she wrote some poems about, you know, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, the great boxing matches of the 70s. But she was a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, right?
Yes. Yes, she was. She lived in Chicago her whole life, and I'm from St. Louis, and her writing was just a big part of my childhood, and the way she used words and language just really spoke to me in a very personal, kind of an empowering way, and mm-hmm. it was like an amazing point to start a thread for the beginning of this record. And
So what was that thread? What was the kind of the idea that took you through this album?
We wanted to write an album with a particular focus on the kind of sense of self and internalization of the outside world, but coming from a very like strong and internalized perspective. For me personally, and I know this is different for Ryan, but you know, it's like a spiritually based sense of beauty that comes out of her poetry that inspired me to write these songs.
Mm-hmm. That can be Ryan, it sounds like it could be a sort of an abstract thing to try and build an album around. So
I think, for us, we've played music together for a long time. And
define long time.
8 years.
Okay.
Played music for a while.
So since you were like 16 or something.
Whoa, yeah, we were 16.
Thanks so much. Thank you very much. I definitely did not come at this record from Gwendolyn Brooks poetry, but I think, you know, since our lives are intertwined quite a bit in playing and touring and writing and working and all this stuff, I think in general we have some semblance of the same life, right? Mm-hmm. We're in kind of the same spot. And so I think I came at it from a slightly different angle, but I think we worked really well together in the writing of these things. For me, it's the idea of being very present and not living in the past and not being too worried about what's happening in the future, but it's really a theme about being present in the moment, which is not the easiest thing for me to do.
Yeah.
And so these songs, at least my lyrical contributions, were an attempt to express that and try to really make this record an experience that people can have, you know, while they're listening to it, about being in the present.
Now, can you do that? Can you, you know, write stuff that where you don't want to be living in the past and still be, you know, referring to the sounds of classic American R&B and soul and rock and all the things that are alluded, jazz, all the things that are alluded to in the way you voice the chords, the way you arrange the rhythms and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, I feel like now is the time to do it more than any time. You know, I think even trying to assemble all those different influences right now it's unavoidable, right? With the amount of music and media that we're exposed to, there's no escaping reference. Mm-hmm. Everything's referential now. So yeah. I think that's inevitable, but it's in, and but yeah, we made it, and even with the language, we made an attempt to avoid language of, I really wanted to do this. I'm really trying my best at this, or this thing hurt me, or whatever. It's more about just the now, I guess.
So what is the reference in the title Howard Two Hands, which is the next song you're going to do?
That was actually initially written, most of that song, by Don Godwin, who was in the band, mm-hmm. and he gracefully bowed out because he couldn't do touring, but he was very creatively involved with the record, and he was
drumming on his legs while he was waiting for the train at the Howard Beach station.
Yeah.
And it was a two-handed
the A train.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So he's playing he plays a lot of marching band drum, and so he was just tapping a rhythm out on his legs, and so it's the two-handed rhythm waiting for the train at Howard Beach. That's how he kind of organizes
Howard
all of his
Beach. Yeah. Okay. All right. I knew if we dug deep enough, we'd get to the bottom of this title. Shall we hear the song?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right. The band is Callers. The album's called Reviver. It is their third record out on October 9th. We're getting a preview of it live in the Soundcheck studio today. Once again, this song called, for reasons that we have now determined and hopefully understand, Howard Two Hands. Callers, live on Soundcheck.
Steam arms and hide their eyes off of the swing. My arms
Cool. Howard Two Hands is the name of that song from the band Callers, playing it live here in the studio. Once again, Sarah Lucas singing, playing guitar. Ryan Seaton playing guitar, did some backing vocals earlier. Seth Manchester on guitar. Keith Souza playing the drums. And, boy, there's, I mean, for a piece that Sarah is built around, as you told us, this kind of rhythm, it's like skittering all over the place. I mean, are you all just, like, counting like crazy when you're playing this?
Well, Keith's really holding it down over there.
I mentioned that, you know, three of you are playing guitars. Who's playing the bass role? Does that sort of move around?
I mean, there's a couple of spots, I guess, in the set where Seth takes over the bass, but generally I'm playing bass and guitar at the same time, and that just came from Sarah and I played as a duo for years and then as a trio, and just to fill up space without adding additional people, mm-hmm. I took over the role of bass.
So do you have like extra thick gauge strings at the bottom of the guitar?
They're heavy gauge strings for guitar, but nothing special, not baritone strings or bass strings or anything.
All
just down tunings.
Now, Sarah, you mentioned you're originally from St. Louis, mm-hmm. although you and Ryan met in New Orleans some years ago, right?
Yes.
I mean, as jazz and the blues moved up the Mississippi River, St. Louis was like, that was a place where a lot of music was happening. Not necessarily this kind of music. What did you grow up listening to?
I grew up listening to a lot of R&B, like contemporary R&B, like commercial R&B, old classic R&B, lots of soul, gospel, jazz. Those were a lot of the main influences when I was very young.
Yeah? Like, who were your vocal heroes? When you started singing?
At what
point
in my life? I have so many people that I, you know, would spend a few years trying to do everything they could do with their voice, with mm-hmm. my own.
But there must have been one who made you think, I need to be able to do that.
I can't really think of anyone in particular, but I can throw out some names. I think, you know, the first person that I remember, and I must have been like five, but I sat down with Tapestry, Carole King.
The Carole King.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, the words, the lyrics to the songs for that record are all on the back of the record. And I just remember sitting in front of my parents' stereo and singing to all of those songs over and over and just learning it by heart. And then hearing the Isley Brothers play Carole King, or, you know, I love Luther Vandross.
And let's not, I mean, you have to understand that every time we're in the van, it doesn't matter where we're traveling, where we're touring. If Mary J. Blige comes on the stereo, there will be tears. it's immediate.
She affects you that deeply, Ryan?
No.
Oh, whatever.
I like Mary.
Yeah, I mean, I think every 12-year-old girl, when Real Love came out, you know, I was 12 when it came out, I think. And I do remember thinking, well, you know, I want to sing Real Love like that.
So Mary J. Blige doing it for Sarah Lucas. Ryan Seaton, growing up in, was it Arkansas?
Arkansas, yeah.
What kind of musical background did you have?
I mean, just starting as a kid, I always played something. Starting at 4 or 5, I started playing piano. And then in high school, there were just a lot of really great musicians and artists in Little Rock and North Little Rock that got together and put on shows all the time. So there were just a lot of art rock bands and punk bands and just kind of playing off the city's power, or in small, you know, this happened all over the country in the early 90s when I was growing up.
So it sounds like the two of you had very different kind of musical upbringings.
Yeah, I think the general area of the country, I mean, we had different upbringings to an extent, but still being from the South/Midwest, that kind of area in there, I think whether you want to or not, you are still exposed to a lot of, you know, music that came out of that area.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, I think that was in the ether in general, but then I think the way that we explored were, you know, our paths were a little different growing up.
Well, now you've got this third record out, or coming out on October 9th, called Reviver. The sort of the epic tune, the longest song, is this one you're going to do for us next, called Turning. Ryan, can you set this up for us?
Yeah, this is one of the songs that just came very slowly together over, I don't know, a year or so. We would kept returning to it and adding another part, and it just kind of kept growing outward. It's kind of the whole thing repeats, the whole form repeats twice, but it just kind of, one part led into another, where there was no real repetition, and then we just decided to play the whole thing again. And it just came from one of those moments where, you know, someone left the practice space for a minute and a groove started happening.
I think that what's really important about the song and the reason why we wanted to play it today is that, you know, it was the first song we thought about recording and writing, and it was way before Keith and Seth came into the process of, because they helped co-produce this record, mm-hmm. And engineer all the sounds and everything, and they had a very much a powerful impact on the sound of the record and the tone. And this song in particular, it really took shape in the studio with kind of the decisions that we all made together and the new sounds that you know, they were kind of introducing into the palette of the record, the sonic record. So, yeah.
Okay, well, let's put the four of you back together then and hear another live performance. The band, Callers, the album will be called Reviver. It's out on October 9th. We're getting a preview of it live in the Soundcheck studio today. And this song is called Turning. Once again, live on Soundcheck, the band Callers.
When I thought I was breaking, you turned my love around. When I thought I was breaking, you turned my love around. When I thought I was falling, you turned my love around. Oh, you turned me right round. Your patience makes me realize you are my everything.
What we miss, we intone to reminisce.
Band Callers, live on Soundcheck, and that's going to do it for today's show. I'm John Schaefer. Be with us again next time for another Soundcheck.
Sound.